Welcome to Y2K, the podcast where your host, Amanda Ladino, escapes her existence and subsequent existential crisis into the peaceful portal of films from before the year 2000. This week, we're discussing Kiki's Delivery Service, a 1989 urban fantasy film about child labor and burnout. Nike actually plays this in their factories to motivate their slaves, valued workers. Kiki is resting on her laurels when she hears on the radio that there's going to be a full moon and clear skies tonight. And she decides to throw all her plans to the wind and tells her father that he and his packing trip and the boring-ass dress that her mom made for her can get fucked because she is stepping out tonight. And with a quick smack of the broom, Kiki peels out into some trees and eventually into the sky, and her cat familiar Gigi are ready to make it in the big city. After some rain and a quick train ride, Kiki and Gigi find their city and are determined to make a good first impression by slamming into a bus and almost causing multiple accidents. And after almost being arrested and being told by the city folk that they don't give a flying fuck about her, Kiki is sulking and worrying about how she's going to survive when she sees Osono, bakery owner who's trying to return a baby at Spinky that was left in the bakery. Kiki offers to quickly deliver the Binky via broomstick, and soon she's in business. Osono offers Kiki free lodging, phone use, and breakfast in exchange for working a few shifts, and Kiki is ready to put Amazon Prime out of business, because she's a great flyer, according to the multiple collisions she's been in the past 2 days. Between overworking herself for ungrateful clients and feeling like she can't fit in with the other kids who don't have to work, and being borderline harassed by an overenthusiastic aviation nerd, Kiki is burnt out and has lost the ability to talk to Gigi and fly her broom. Luckily, her friend Ursula, who she met during one of her deliveries, invites Kiki to her cabin in the woods. It's not as ominous as it sounds. Ursula gives Kiki some sound advice on dealing with burnout by relaxing and remembering why you liked your craft in the first place. And soon, Kiki is ready to fly again just in time to save Tombo from the clock tower after the dirigible blimp crashed into it. After this feat of heroism, the city people all love Kiki for the current moment. You're now entering our fax machine portion of the pod where we discuss facts about the film. Kiki's Delivery Service was originally released on July 29, 1989. Streamline had an English dub released in 1989, and then Disney released an English dub in 1997. In 2010, Disney re-released an English dub that was edited to be more true to the 1989 Japanese dub. However, the audio mix was also adjusted and sounds more filtered, resulting in some of the dialogue sounding odd, like when Kiki screams and it sounds like she's talking through a fan. The movie had a budget of $6 million and overall grossed $41 million. It was the first Studio Ghibli movie that was a success when it was released. The movie is based on a novel of the same name by Eiko Kodono. The character of Kiki in the movie is inspired by Kiki from the novel and the 13-year-old daughter of the film's producer, Toshio Suzuki. Miyazaki was the movie's original producer, but eventually took over the roles of director and screenwriter after being unsatisfied with the prior staff's vision for the movie. The original running time of the film was 80 minutes. Once Miyazaki became director, this was extended to 90 minutes, and after storyboarding, the running time was 102 minutes. The character of Gigi is present in the book, but according to Miyazaki, in the movie, he is made more into a coward. After hearing Gigi's voice, Miyazaki thought that Gigi appeared odd when being assertive because he's not independent. He's a part of Kiki, and he's supposed to represent the immature part of her that is supposed to grow, which is why at the end of the film, once Kiki finally grows up, or starts to grow up, she can't hear Gigi anymore. The novel was comprised of small stories with various characters and incidents that occur during Kiki's deliveries. As Kiki grows, she overcomes these challenges and makes new friends. The book is not as dramatic as the movie. Most notably, Kiki doesn't have any crises in the novel. Miyazaki said, "When I make a film, I begin by having a very clear concept of why I have to make it in the first place. What kind of film will it be? What is going to be conveyed? What is the purpose of making this film? I don't make films to send out a message. That might be part of the work involved in clarifying the concept, but it's not enough to send a message. The film has to be entertaining." On the concept of Kiki's delivery service, Miyazaki said, "When I first came across Kiki, the first image that occurred to me was a small girl flying across a city at night. A sea of lights, but not a single one offers her a warm welcome. There's a profound loneliness high above the city. In flying, one may no longer be confined to land, but this freedom also implies insecurity and loneliness. The heroine of our film is a girl who defines herself by flying. There have been many animation films based on witch girls, but their magic is only a device to realize their wishes. They function as celebrity idols without any real problems. The witch's magic in Kiki's delivery service doesn't come so easily. Magic in this film is a limited power, no different from the talents of any average girl. Later on, as she flies above the city, Kiki feels a strong connection to the people below. But her sense of self is much stronger than it was at the beginning. Ultimately, this film celebrates a young person's struggle to become independent. Miyazaki wanted to make the movie to support and provide understanding for kids when they're overcoming their difficult period of self-doubt. So Miyazaki added these tougher stories to add a sense of realism and to more explicitly show the struggle of growing up and being independent and the loneliness and stress that comes with this. The movie pretty much follows the book up until Kiki's departure for the city. When Kiki starts her delivery service in the book, the story pretty much is about Kiki's effort to fulfill difficult deliveries, and growing up was each little episodic story. Kiki's acceptance by the city is also different than in the movie. In the movie, she's accepted for saving Tombo. In the book, she's accepted for saving a kid who was taken out to sea while swimming at the beach. The movie also expands upon some characters from the book. In the book, Ursula is just an unnamed painter and client of Kiki's. And Tombo befriends Kiki and helps her because he breaks her broom. The book also covers an entire year, while the movie only covers a summer. The end credits of the movie are designed as a sequel because Miyazaki didn't want to just show a list of creators' names. He wanted the audience to see Kiki happy so that they could leave in a good mood. In the end credits, Kiki is writing her parents to describe her time in the city and how her training is coming along, with snippets of the other characters' recent whereabouts. In the book, the final chapter is Kiki describing her first visit home after her training is completed. Kiki plans to stay home for a bit after she completes her training, but then realizes that she misses Kuriko and flies back, and the book ends with Kiki pointing down at the city and telling Gigi, "See, that's our city." The novel's author, Kodono, did not like these changes and almost pulled the rights away, but ultimately decided to let the project continue after visiting with Miyazaki. Miyazaki imagined Kuriko as an old European city in the 50s that was in a world that never experienced a war. The primary model of Kuriko was Visby, Sweden. The production artist traveled to Sweden and took photographs of Stockholm and Visby, and they added these elements as well as elements of Lisbon, Amsterdam, Paris, Naples, San Francisco, and Milan to the architecture. The only architecture that deviated from their geographical inspirations was the bakery. According to Hiroshi Ono, the bakery was based on the setting, but they didn't see any wooden buildings on their research trip. However, Ono was impressed by chimneys that turn with the wind direction, so he wanted to use that for the bakery chimney. To illustrate Kiki's house in her hometown, Ono wanted to emulate Kiki's house from the novel that was surrounded by flowers, giving it a fairy tale look. Ursula's painting was an actual print called Ship Flying Over the Rainbow. Miyazaki wanted a painting that conveyed the life of a secluded female artist rather than conveying a specific message. Katsuya Kondo, who designed the look of Kiki in the movie, originally wanted to emulate the novel's illustrations and have Kiki with long hair, but this would be too difficult to animate, so Kondo shortened Kiki's hair but kept the ribbons that bundled her hair. To tie all of these aspects together, they needed to determine the overall color scheme of the movie. The illustrators divided the color charts into three groups. Chart 1 was approximation of primary colors, which are overall bright and the most popular colors for animation films. Chart 2 were relatively natural colors, which have texture, but the colors are more restrained than the neutral colors used in animation films. And chart 3 was nearly natural colors, where the color is quite restrained. The illustrators originally thought the colors should be flashy, but when they tested it, they thought it looked cheap and superficial. But they didn't want a natural look because they had used that in their last two films. And they wanted to avoid primary colors because you don't typically find that in the main city setting that they were emulating. So they primarily applied Chart 2's relatively natural colors with Chart 1's neutral colors and Chart 3's nearly natural colors as the textures and used primary colors for detailing. Flying into our most excellent portion of the pod, where I discuss my favorite things about this movie, first and foremost, let's talk about the architecture. Every building is beautiful, but especially Kiki's hometown home and the older lady's home. The architecture of the city is fun and light, but it's also congested as cities are. And these two houses just breathe nature and space into the frame. The other true decorative masterpiece in this movie is the stunning, the vibrant, the intricate, the lush rug that is in Kett's house. It belongs in every 1980s Miami household. I also enjoy the realistic portions of this movie that I think a lot of people have experienced growing up, like when Kiki meets a mean witch and freaks out, which has happened to every kid and adult. When you meet someone who is more confident in appearance, and then you immediately have a crisis about your life. I mean, that's the basis of social media and family gatherings. Off track, but a cute detail that I like in that scene is that the mean witch says that she tells fortunes about love, and she's wearing cute little heart earrings, and I just love that. And everyone has tried to act cool and then immediately absolutely ate it. Like when Kiki tells Gigi to smile so they make a good impression and immediately crashes into a bus. I mean, we've all pulled the door when we should have pushed. The movie also perfectly demonstrates what it's like to move to a city and start to grow up once you realize that no one cares about you, even if you have magical powers. The movie also illustrates really well what it's like to work in the service industry. I started working in the food service industry when I was 16, and your view of people completely changes. You realize that they aren't smart, they aren't put together, and most of them are rude and unaware, but you deal with them because that's a job. And you remember the people who are nice to you, and you see Kiki go through this disillusionment and acceptance. Kiki can get on my nerves a bit, but in all fairness, she is a kid, and she makes the mistakes that all kids make. I mean, we were all a bit rude or short with our parents or other kids, or too stubborn at some point. Miyazaki has said that Kiki's too proud, but she doesn't know what to do about it. Being a kid and sometimes an adult means digging your heels in, even if you know that the person you're arguing is right, but you don't want to give in now, so you're just gonna argue a point that you disagree with for the next half hour. And even though it is rude and mean, I understand Kiki not wanting to go and catch up with Tombo and explain why she's late, and instead choosing to go straight to her bed and curl up under her covers and not speak to anyone and just be sad for a bit. I've done it. It's Spotify's got the musical proof. I listen to Mitski. I'm not ashamed. And I, like Kiki, am a real trooper whenever I am sick. So I wholeheartedly relate to Kiki asking Osono if she's gonna die when she just has a little cold. Osono is said to be a soon-to-be mother, but that's a lie. She is the mother. She is so supportive of Kiki from the minute she meets her. She is just the kindest person you ever want to meet. She gives Kiki a free room, phone, and breakfast just for Kiki working a few shifts. And yes, she already had all of these items on hand, but she could be renting that stuff out to someone. But instead, she decides to help out a kid who had nowhere to go. Osono also pays Kiki to make a delivery to Tombo to forcefully give Kiki the opportunity to apologize to Tombo for standing him up. And Osono covers the cost of this delivery and the cost of this product. And another cute detail I love is in the original Japanese version, Osono offers Kiki coffee, not hot cocoa, which you can clearly tell once you know, because the quote-unquote cocoa falls like instant coffee grounds and Osono puts out cream and sugar. Continuing on the subject of Osono, her husband is the ideal man. He is supportive. He makes Kiki a sign out of braided bread. I mean, I don't think they could do that on the British Bake Off. He has the shoulder span of an ox. He does little bakery pan tricks to impress Gigi. And he stays up waiting with Osono for Kiki at nighttime when she makes deliveries. I ultimately like the decision to have Osono's husband not speak. Miyazaki said this was because Kiki wouldn't notice if he spoke anyway and would be uncomfortable if he, a grown man, spoke directly to her. So the husband is just supportive, but doesn't need to be gregarious about it. And then we're introduced to Ursula, who is played by the alternative queen, Janine Garofalo. Her outfit is timeless and would look amazing on Monica and Friends, who was actually written to be played by Janine Garofalo, but she turned down the role. I personally would love to have a friend who has a cabin surrounded by gorgeous evergreen trees, who paints and drinks tea and maybe has some crows as familiars. But crows are nice. They bring you shiny things. My one quarrel is that she takes forever in a day to do a 2-minute repair while Kiki is just crouched down scrubbing her entire house to death. Miyazaki loves a cleaning scene. Every film's gotta have the scrub down scene. Roll up your sleeves, roll up your trousers, get the go-to bucket and brush. The floors are wooden? Oh, fantastic. Get ready for some potential splinters because that grain is exposed. And finally, saving the best for last, Jeff. Jeff is the best character in this whole damn film, and I trust him with my life. He is helpful, he's unselfish, he's a great liar, and a very keen observer. And my absolute favorite thing about this movie is the end credits. I love the end credits. It's such a cute way to see where everyone is at and have assurance that Kiki's gonna be okay. And I love a good montage. It's how you want every sitcom to end so that you know that all the characters still talk to each other. Now, crashing into the tragic, most bogus portion of the pod, where I discuss my least favorite things about the movie. As previously mentioned in our fax machine portion, when they remastered the movie in 2010, they mixed the audio again, causing the voices to sound filtered and sometimes like they were being said into a fan, which you get used to, but it's a little unpleasant to the ears in some scenes. And as I said in our most excellent portion, Kiki is a realistic kid, but sometimes kids do annoying stuff, and I get that it's because they don't know any better. But if I'm being honest about what I didn't like in the movie, sometimes, you know, Kiki annoyed me a bit. Like, I didn't like when she just tells her mom that she's leaving tonight rather than in a month as previously planned. And then she cancels the camping trip her dad planned and packed for. I mean, that would not slide when I was growing up. Going on a trip requires planning out routes, living situations, job situations. Going on the fly, pun intended, just makes you vulnerable to trouble and danger, and the stress is unbearable for me. Keeping with kids being kind of annoying sometimes because they're kids, Tombo is way too pushy. He comes on way too strong to Kiki. I really did not care for Tombo asking Osono what she could tell him about Kiki. I get it. I know he's trying to be nice and likes her, but she shows multiple times that she is just interested in being maybe friends, maybe. And Kiki really comes in hot when she yells at Tombo during their first introduction, or lack thereof, according to Kiki, which reminded me of when I was a kid and repeat stuff that my parents would say to me or rules my parents had. And then I'd realize that these were not commonly held ideas. Throughout the movie, you see this push and pull between the two of them, trying to be friends, but then ultimately situations and growing up in different environments getting in the way. And Miyazaki did say he doesn't think Tombo and Kiki become romantically involved, but they will become good friends, which I am for. I am not for a romantic situation between the two for reasons that I already stated. Tombo's way too enthusiastic. My last couple of points are little inconsistencies that I don't hate them, but they just don't really make sense. In the beginning of the movie, Kiki's mom says that Kiki barely knows how to fly, which is then demonstrated when Kiki hits multiple trees and can't turn on her radio whilst flying and then full-on slams into a bus. So it seems odd that within that same two-day period, Kiki decides that her special skill is flying. Maybe Kiki doesn't possess any other witch skill. Maybe that's why. I just felt like we could have had just a little more clarification. And in one scene, Kiki starts brushing her hair at dusk, like it's still kind of dark out. And then when she finishes brushing her hair, it is full on sunny. How long is she brushing that bob haircut for? Transporting into our peaceful portal where I discuss what about this film is comforting to me, this movie is a little slow and doesn't have a high-octane plot, I'll admit it, but it is the perfect little film to have playing in the background while folding laundry, when you're at home sick or exhausted and just need to relax and deal with your own burnout. So deliver yourself a treat and watch Kiki's Delivery Service. Thanks for listening, and thank you for joining me in escaping my existence into the peaceful portal of films from before the year 2000. I hope you'll join me in our next episode on Working Girl. This podcast is released every other Tuesday on all listening platforms. If you liked the episode, please rate and review our podcast on your listening platform of choice. Apple Podcasts is preferred, but any support is appreciated. Or you can also tell a friend or a loved one, or even a stranger, that you think would like the show to give it a listen. Any and all support is appreciated. If you want to keep updated on the pod between releases, you can catch us on Instagram and Facebook at y_2_k_? And on Letterboxd at Y2KPod. Thanks for listening to Y2K. We love you something fierce. And thank you to Yusu Kim for our totally rad theme song and Abani Cohen for our gnarly-ass podcast art.